This is edition number 2025 of The Mardler, recorded at Aylsham on Friday the 10th of July 2026. Hello, and a warm welcome to The Mardler, the weekly talking newspaper. Just one item from the notice board this week. The sun rises at around 4:45 in the morning and sets at around 9:15 in the evening. Our week's news and views are from the North Norfolk News of Thursday, the 9th of July. I am Judith Elliott Hunter, and my fellow readers are
Mary Wilson,
Robert Watton,
and Jill Mellows.
The magazine supplement, which includes The Joy of Wild Norfolk, How We Check the Time, Historical Treasures, an up-and-coming Norfolk festival, and a report from our roving reporter follows later. But first, shocking photo captures wildfire fought by more than 100 firefighters. Council wraps up cleaning effort as Norfolk beaches hit by summer tourist surge. Bids vying for Town of Culture take next step with postcards. However, we lead with councillor urges parents to tackle your behaviour. An angry councillor has urged parents to take more responsibility for their children amid growing concerns over antisocial behaviour in Sheringham. The warning follows reports of large groups of teenagers and young adults gathering on the town's putting green, with incidents including alcohol use, littering, and disruptive behaviour. Locals have also reported broken glass on the beach near the lifeboat station, excessive noise and abuse directed at nearby homeowners. North Norfolk councillor Liz Witherington said Norfolk police were increasing patrols in the area. She added they were regularly engaging with those involved, confiscating alcohol and, where necessary, returning young people home to speak with their parents. Miss Witherington highlighted concerns about youth safety, including the risk of county lines, drugs, exploitation, warning that young people in quieter coastal towns could be particularly vulnerable. She said, "No one wants to stop young people having fun, but we need to keep them safe and ensure they understand the consequences of their actions." Ms. Witherington said free activities, including Friday evening sessions at the Reef Leisure Centre, had seen low attendance, despite efforts to provide safe alternatives. She said police were also monitoring vehicle-related antisocial behaviour in the town centre, including loud exhausts, dangerous driving, and repeated cruising. Members of the public are being encouraged to submit footage and number plates to assist the police operation. Ms. Witherington warned that Section 59 notices, a formal warning, could lead to vehicle seizures. For those young drivers who think a Section 59 notice is a joke or a badge of honour, I'm sure the two drivers who had their motorbike and car confiscated and crushed last year don't think that now. Unlawful exhausts, deliberate backfiring, loud music blasting at night, repeated town centre laps, roaring engines all come under Section 59. Not only do you make town centres unsafe, but many people in the centre and beyond, and in particular families with children, are disturbed. It is not a good look for our tourism-focused town either.
A shocking photo has been released showing the extent of a huge wildfire. The blaze broke out in Swanton Abbott Road, near Swanton Abbott, south of North Walsham, at around 6 p.m. on Monday. The road was closed while crews fought the fire, which spread quickly and involved outbuildings as well as 50 hectares of fields. In total, 27 crews were called to the incident, including from Aylsham, North Walsham, Stalham, Munsley, Wroxham, Earlham and Sheringham. Tactical response vehicles from Sandringham, Diss, Galston, Cromer, Wroxham, North Walsham and Reefham were also at the scene, alongside two water carriers from Heatherset and one from Fakenham. A drone to track fire spread and farm machinery was used to create a fire break to prevent further spread. Please stay well clear of fires in the open as they can spread quickly and can be unpredictable, a spokesman from Norfolk Fire and Rescue Service said. Do not stop to take photographs, which may put you in danger. There were other fires in the open on Monday afternoon, including at Crimplesham, Elmerton and Bintree. The fire service had previously warned against using barbecues or lighting bonfires in forests or open spaces outdoors. Norfolk is experiencing more hot weather this week, with Thetford expected to hit 31°C on Thursday, while it will be 29°C in King's Lynn and 27°C in Norwich. The UK Health Security Agency, UKHSA, has upgraded its yellow health alert to amber in the east of England. The alert will be in place from 9 a.m. on Wednesday until 9 p.m. on Sunday. It comes after the county experienced the UK's hottest ever day, with Lingwood reaching temperatures of 37.6°C.
The sandy beaches and seaside towns of the North Norfolk coastline attract hundreds of thousands of tourists each year. But the sheer scale of summer footfall has led to a spike in litter being left on the sand and promenades. In response, North Norfolk District Council has brought in temporary summer measures to cope with the peak season crowds. New steps include more staff, extra toilet cleaning, and dozens of additional bins along the coast. The busiest seafronts, Sheringham, Munsley, Cromer and Wells, now have four extra barrow beats patrolling the promenades until 8:30 p.m. A barrow beat is a street cleaning council worker using hand barrows to clean and maintain public streets. A second afternoon cleansing vehicle has also been added to the rota, on top of the five early morning runs that already empty bins and collect bagged rubbish. This is to catch the late evening peak when bins are more likely to overflow. After the uproar in Sea Pauling when rubbish was left mounted up on the bins, the council hopes the extra vehicle will stop waste spilling onto the sand and being blown along the shoreline. Extra staff have been allocated to clean public toilets in the afternoons, and more than 44 additional litter bins have been deployed along the promenades. 10 specialist bins for disposable barbecues, metal or sand-lined containers designed to take hot coals safely, have been installed to stop people dumping still hot barbecues in general bins or burying them in the sand. Norfolk has 6 blue flag beaches, signalling a beach is clean, safe and environmentally well managed. North Norfolk District Council said, "Our towns and beaches are among the top reasons residents and visitors alike flock to North Norfolk, and we celebrate being a destination in demand. Where possible, we ask members of the public to take their litter home with them for disposal to help keep the whole district clean." A tourism survey for 2024 showed 9.4 million trips were undertaken in the district, with £463 million spent by tourists during their trips. A joint effort has been launched to make sure a beach will not be plagued with litter again during the next heatwave. Sea Pauling beach bins were overflowing with litter during a heatwave at the end of June, which saw temperatures reach 37 degrees centigrade in some parts of Norfolk. Sea Pauling and Waxham Parish Council have responded to the concerns about rubbish on the beach and promenade. The Parish Council says it has been working with North Norfolk District Council to find practical solutions. A spokesman for the Parish Council said, "We are grateful to the local residences, businesses and volunteers who have helped with litter picking to help the beach and promenade as clean as possible. Their efforts are greatly appreciated." The Parish Council said it has been in constant contact with North Norfolk District Council's cleansing department and is working closely together to find practical solutions to this issue. "We recognise that the recent spell of hot weather has brought significantly increased numbers of visitors, placing additional pressure on existing waste collection arrangements." The council said it will continue to work with the district council to explore measures that help manage increased demand during peak periods. A new group of litter pickers has formed to tackle rubbish piling up on a North Norfolk beach. Cromer litter pickers has been launched in response to reports of litter blighting the town's seafront. The volunteer groups plan to organise regular volunteer litter picks, mainly focusing on the beach and promenade. Cromer litter pickers said, "You may have seen recent reports of litter on Cromer beaches, which is upsetting and mindless. We have started this page to energise the good people of Cromer to get together and volunteer to collect litter." During June's heatwave, Councillor Callum Ringer picked up 4 stacks of rubbish on the beach. This sparked a strong reaction online from locals about the impact on marine life and tourism. The blue flag status of the beach was also highlighted as one to protect. Cromer Litter Pickers has linked up with North Norfolk District Council to borrow equipment and arrange bag collections. The group is also appealing to local businesses that may be able to contribute to the cost of high-vis vests.
The next stage in the battle to be named the most cultural place in our region saw postcards being created describing which towns hope to be named best in the land. 9 bids from across Norfolk and Suffolk have taken the next step to become the UK's first town of culture. Communities hoping to secure the prestigious title submitted digital postcards to the Department for Culture, Media and Sport, DCMS, highlighting everything from seaside heritage and market town charm to thriving art scenes and community spirit. The postcards are now featured on the official UK Town of Culture 2028 digital map, giving towns a chance to showcase what makes them unique as judges consider the next stage of the competition. Cromer and Sheringham put centuries of friendly rivalry to one side for a joint North Norfolk coast bid. Their postcard celebrates a place where wild landscapes, rich heritage and creativity shape everyday life, and argues culture can help communities thrive while tackling inequality. It has been brought forward through collaboration between Sheringham Little Theatre, local cultural organisations, and Liz Withington, North Norfolk District Councillor for Sheringham. Great Yarmouth's submission highlights its medieval rose, maritime heritage, and community celebrations. It describes itself as a town of pride, imagination, and resilience, where historic traditions sit alongside ambitious plans for the future. Great Yarmouth Borough Council had said its concept will build on 3 themes reflecting Great Yarmouth's character and future opportunities. Fakenham's postcard adopts the style of a holiday message, praising its weekly market, independent shops and strong community spirit. The Market Towns bid will lean on its 170-year printing heritage, placing the town as a contributor to storytelling. Wells Next the Sea uses its entry to champion the town's festivals and events, while highlighting the challenges young people face in finding affordable housing and jobs. The postcard reads, "So sad that so many young people have to leave our town for further education, work and an affordable home." The bid is entitled Tides of Change, reflecting how the town's past, present and future are deeply connected. Aylsham's postcard paints a picture of a community packed with creativity, describing music, art and history around every corner. North Walsham chose to focus on the people behind its cultural life, highlighting volunteers, performers and organisers involved in an outdoor production telling the story of the 1381 Peasants' Revolt. The winner of the first UK Town of Culture competition will receive £3 million to stage a major cultural programme in 2028, while 2 runners-up will be awarded £250,000. And we can now add a footnote. Great Yarmouth was announced as a finalist on Friday night.
2 ancient hand axes found in North Norfolk that are believed to be around 500,000 years old have been barred from leaving the UK. Discovered on the Haysborough shoreline, the flint tools have been blocked from export by Culture Minister Baroness Twycross. The decision leaves UK museums and institutions the chance to acquire the artefacts. Baroness Twycross said, "These hand axes present a window into the lives of some of our oldest ancestors. The Britain they inhabited was very different from our own, and items like these provide a valuable insight into a world that is extremely difficult to research. I hope these hand axes can find a UK buyer, so that we can all share the revelations that bring about some of Britain's very first settlers." The tools were revealed by storms that stripped away layers of clay, exposing ancient land surfaces beneath the beach. Shaped using stone or antler hammers, the hand axes have sharp edges designed for cutting and scraping and could have been used without handles. One is 13 centimetres long and weighs 465 grams with orange-brown staining from the sediments. The other is just over 10 centimetres and 308 grams, featuring light brown and grey colouring and a patch of chalky cortex. Tim Pestle, a member of the Reviewing Committee on the Export of Works of Art and Objects of Cultural Interest, said, "It is hard to overstate the importance of finds from Haysborough to scientific knowledge and to our nation's history. I therefore earnestly hope that these hand axes will be preserved in a museum collection where they can be accessible to both the general public on display and to the research community to continue unlocking their secrets. A decision on the export licence has been deferred until September the 2nd. During this time, UK institutions can seek to acquire either hand axe at £15,000 plus VAT.
The former director of an animal sanctuary near Norwich has been charged with a spate of animal welfare offences. Liz Hall, 46, of Shortthorne Road, Stratton Strawless, faces 15 charges relating to the treatment of animals. The charges come after a police raid, which was assisted by the RSPCA at Hawswood Animal Sanctuary near Norwich on September 16, 2024. Several animals were seized under Section 18 of the Animal Welfare Act during the raid, and the charges relate to more than 300 birds and animals. The incident caused Hall to step down from her role as the director of the sanctuary at the time. Two charges relate to causing unnecessary suffering to animals, and three further charges relate to failing to meet the welfare needs of animals. Hall also faces four charges linked to invasive non-native species, including the keeping and release or escape of grey squirrels and muntjac deer. She has also been charged with possessing wild birds. A further five charges relate to veterinary medicines and drugs, including the possession of unauthorised veterinary medicines, possession and use of veterinary products without authority, administering an injurious substance to protected animals, and possession of controlled drugs, namely a Class A drug, Oromorph, and a Class C drug, diazepam. Hall is due to appear at Norwich Magistrates Court on August 25th.
A primary school closed for almost 7 years is to reopen with a new purpose after plans were approved to transform the site. The former Stalham Community Infant School will become a specialist base for children with special educational needs and disabilities, SEND, to address a shortage of such places in the county. Officials in Norfolk County Council's planning department have approved proposals from the authority's education department to make the changes at the former Stalham school site off Brumstead Road. The authority, against a backdrop of rising demand and associated costs for SEND support in Norfolk, has been building a number of such specialist bases around the county. The idea is that such places help keep SEND children within mainstream education while curtailing spending on private providers and transport costs. The new base at Stalham will provide 24 places for youngsters with social, emotional and mental health needs. Officials said the base will provide a specialist curriculum and social, emotional and mental health need support that enables pupils to regulate their emotions and access education within a mainstream school. Pupils will benefit from high staff ratios, small group provision and specialist evidence-informed interventions. The scheme would see a full refurbishment and remodelling of the former school buildings, which have been vacant since July the 31st, 2019, when the school moved to Old Yarmouth Road. The revamp will create a new configuration of classrooms, curriculum areas, intervention and meeting rooms, administration areas and toilets. Council officials said the new base would employ the equivalent of 4 full-time teachers, 1 pastoral manager and 3 teaching assistants when running at full capacity. The plans include a new access road off Brumstead Road, with officials saying the current route into the site would not meet highway safety requirements. In granting permission, officers said significant weight is given in the planning balance to the fact that Norfolk County Council, as the local education authority, has a statutory duty to ensure sufficient school places are available across the county. A shortfall in provision for pupils with special needs in this part of the county has been identified. National planning policy is supportive of the expansion and or alteration of schools to meet the needs of existing and new communities.
A planning bid for a new self-build home on land in a village has been dismissed on appeal. The proposals were put forward by Kim Burgess for a detached property on land at Craymere Manor in Briston between Holt and Fakenham. The home would have included 4 bedrooms, a kitchen, dining room, lounge, ensuite, office and garage, among other features. North Norfolk District Council refused the plans in September 25, citing the impacts on the rural character of the village as well as neighbouring properties. The council added, "It is not considered that a single dwelling in the location proposed would contribute in any meaningful way to maintaining or enhancing the vitality of the local rural community, nor would it contribute to the delivery of sustainable development." Ms Burgess put forward an appeal with the Planning Inspectorate, which rules over planning disputes. In a statement on her behalf, it was argued that the home makes efficient use of land in a sustainable settlement. The statement added that the proposal would not result in unacceptable living conditions for surrounding occupiers, with only one immediate neighbour to the site who raised no objections. It also pointed to a range of benefits provided by the development, including contribution to housing supply, short-term construction employment, and support towards local services and facilities. However, the appeal was dismissed by the Planning Inspectorate on June the 30th. Although the social and economic benefits of the development were acknowledged, it added that these were significantly and demonstrably outweighed by the collective harm of the adverse impacts. This included the location, impact on the character and appearance of the area, and the lack of private amenity space for the home.
A children's bookshop has officially closed its doors after 40 years and is in the process of moving to its new site. Norfolk Children's Book Centre in Olby near Aylsham is beginning a new chapter by moving to Wroxham Barnes. The shop is run by Matt Brocklehurst and his partner Annie Rhodes after the pair took it over from Mr Brocklehurst's mum and librarian Marilyn Brocklehurst. Last summer, Mrs Brocklehurst revealed that she would be selling her house, which is where the shop remained, until closing for the final time on June the 27th. In order to finance the move, the store put out an appeal to raise £40,000 to complete the new and improved Norfolk Children's Book Centre. Ms Rose said the new space is looking fantastic already and the finishing touches are being put into the place before the build starts. Ian Russell, owner of Wroxham Barnes, added, "We're absolutely delighted to welcome the Norfolk Children's Book Centre to Wroxham Barnes this summer. Their passion for inspiring young readers and families perfectly complements what we offer here at Rocks and Barns.
Walcott Stores and Post Office, located on Coast Road in Walcott, has been sold by Nigel and Sarah Adams after many years of service. The convenience store includes an off-licence, a post office, and has been described as a key amenity for locals and visitors alike. The store has been taken over by Anthony and Jenny Benedict, who plan to build on its established reputation and expand its offering. In a statement, Mr. and Mrs. Adams expressed their appreciation for the community and their team. "It's been a pleasure to play our part in making Walcott a lovely village for locals and a destination for visitors and holidaymakers alike," they said. "We would like to take the opportunity to thank the many loyal customers we have served over the last few decades. Thanks also must go to our staff, past and present, as without them we would not have achieved what we have. We wish Anthony, Jenny and their team every success in taking the business forward and hope they will be as well supported and happy as we have been." The couple thanked the former owners for their trust and said they looked forward to meeting the community.
A much-loved cafe near a former train station has been put into liquidation after shutting down. Blackham Station Cafe, which is next to Reefham's disused railway station that closed to passengers in 1952, has been put into voluntary liquidation. Also known as Reefham Station Cafe, the closure was announced in an all-caps Facebook post made by the eatery on May 27th. Simone Daly, Senior Manager of Insolvency and Recovery at Larkin Gowan, said, "I can confirm that Blackham Station was placed into liquidation on June the 30th, with Lee Green and Andrew Kelsall of Larkin Gowan being appointed as the joint liquidators. The closure of the cafe remains unexplained, and the owners, Nicola and Brandon Dixon, have declined to comment. It is understood that several jobs have been lost as a result. The cafe was taken over by the new owners in November 2024. It was hoped they would transform the site into the hub of Reefham, offering a warm space, rich coffee and delicious food. Previously, the business was run by Joanna and Simon Chipperfield, who took over the site in August 2020.
A long-delayed housing development in Corpus D has moved a step closer after key planning conditions were signed off. Broadland Development Services was granted permission by North Norfolk District Council last year to build 38 homes on land off Norwich Road near Holt. The scheme includes 8 properties that will be offered as affordable homes. The council has now approved detailed plans covering construction management, land contamination, fire safety, and legal matters. One condition requires construction workers to park within the site. There will be no parking on the road during building works. A report from the Environmental Health Department identified an isolated piece of asbestos-containing material, ACM, as well as soil that needs screening. The plans are subject to the ACM being removed by the developer, and workers must be briefed on the risk of unexploded ordnance and told to stop work and alert the council if unexpected contamination is found. Proposals for new fire hydrants have also been approved and must be installed before the homes are occupied. A separate legal charge affecting the land has been discharged.
Tollbarn Veterinary Centre, based in North Walsham, has issued a warning about the dangers of grass seeds, which can become a problem, especially at this time of year. Grass seeds have sharp ends, which help them to stick to clothes and fur. The seeds can become embedded in pets' feet, ears, eyes, or even lungs, causing significant discomfort if they are not removed with specialised equipment. A spokesman for the veterinary centre said, "We are already seeing many pets with grass seed or barley awns. If they are removed early on, then no damage is done. However, some grass seeds will manage to pierce the skin and work their way into feet, down ear canals, or into eyes. Pets with grass seeds will usually show signs of pain associated with the location of the grass seed. The vet centre is urging owners to book an appointment if their pet is showing any of these signs, so specialists can check that the culprit is not a grass seed.
Readers have shared more memories of comics, including Elaine Catchpole, who said the article took her back to the 50s and 60s. She said, "My older brother, sister and myself each had a comic delivered weekly with the newspaper, namely The Eagle, Judy and Bunty, respectively. Later on, I too graduated to Jackie. Unfortunately, I no longer have any comics, as my numerous collections of books, postcards, stamps, coins, etc. necessitated that some had to go, or so my husband said. However, I do still have a copy of the Bunty Christmas Annual from 1962 to 1966 and a few Judy Annuals which survived the cull." Jan Napper said, "In the 1950s, I enjoyed reading Robin, then progressed to Bunty. I particularly remember the Four Marys so much so that my mum asked if I wanted to go to a boarding school. As a child, Andy Bolton loved reading comics, including The Victor, Beano, Dandy, and Whizzer and Chips, which he credits with giving him a love of reading going forward in life. He told me, 'I'm now 63 and have a 15-year-old grandson who typically is into gaming and YouTube like most kids these days. However, I got him a subscription to the Beano, which he now gets delivered, and he absolutely loves it.' Funny how things always seem to go full circle." Deb Merry said, "Like you, I love Twinkle and can remember getting the free bracelet. My mum and dad would say, 'Pocket money or comic?' I always went with comic."
The long-lasting marine heatwave could reach extreme levels next week, forecasters have warned. The Met Office said surface waters in northwest European seas, including off the Norfolk coast, are currently experiencing moderate to severe marine heatwave conditions, with many areas currently categorised as strong and some severe. This means waters have reached temperatures usually expected in August and are on average 2 degrees centigrade warmer than usual. They have even reached more than 4 degrees to 5 degrees centigrade warmer locally in some offshore parts of the English and Welsh coasts, the forecasting agency said. It comes after the elevated sea surface temperatures soared in recent days, partly because of last week's unprecedented heatwave driven by climate change and a heat dome that stalled over Europe and trapped heat for days. The UK recorded the hottest June day ever seen, with Lingwood near Norwich seeing a peak of 37.6 degrees centigrade. After a brief cooler spell, forecasters say conditions are heating up again this week, with parts of Norfolk potentially seeing temperatures of over 30 degrees centigrade.
A stranded yachtsman who was caught in difficult conditions was rescued by a lifeboat crew. Cromer RNLI's all-weather lifeboat launched just after 5:30 a.m. on Sunday to help a yacht 1 mile northwest of Cromer. The yacht, with only a single yachtsman on board, had engine failure and could not sail due to the conditions. Volunteer Kevin Johnson, the coxswain, decided the best action was to send crew member Tom Saunders onto the yacht and set up a tow. The crew then towed the yacht towards Wells next to the sea. At around 8:50 a.m, the Wells RNLI lifeboat took over and guided the yacht safely into the harbour. Cromer's lifeboat was back at the station ready for service by 10:30 a.m. Kevin Johnson said, "This was one of those call-outs where everyone on the crew had a part to play. Transferring one of our volunteers onto the yacht and then establishing a tow Both take careful planning and a lot of teamwork, and I was really pleased with the way the crew handled the situation.
Two birdwatching spots in Norfolk have been named among the best RSPB reserves in the UK. Titchwell Marsh and Strumpshaw Fen ranked 14th and 27th in a study by Independent Cottages, making the county part of the UK's top birdwatching highway. The study assessed every RSPB reserve across the UK based on the diversity of bird species, presence of globally endangered species, number of hides and viewpoints, facilities, accessibility and family friendliness. In the last year, many rare birds, such as bittern, a flock of black-tailed godwits and four spoonbills, have been sighted at Titchwell Marsh near Thornham. Strumpshaw Fen has also been a great spot to see spectacular species such as the hawker dragonfly and a red-listed lapwing bird. Independent Cottages said the two Norfolk sites were more practical for families than better-known reserves in Cornwall or Scotland. The East Coast stretch from Norfolk to Lincolnshire was also noted to outperform the rest of the UK, not only in terms of species but also in family infrastructure. Both Titchwell Marsh and Strumpshaw Fen were highlighted for their pushchair access, picnic areas and facilities.
Police have investigated dozens of reports of dogs attacking or worrying farm livestock in Norfolk over the last 5 years. Figures from Norfolk Constabulary reveal that of 67 incidents reported between 2021 and 2025, just three resulted in an owner being charged or summoned, despite the suspects being identified in more than a third of cases. Police identified suspects in 26 reports, but prosecutions did not proceed in 23 of them due to evidential difficulties, while a further 10 resulted in a community resolution. Dogs not being walked on the lead pose a serious danger that they might chase, injure, or kill livestock. Even without physical contact, the stress of being chased can lead to exhaustion and stress and separate young lambs from their mothers. New laws came into force in March that include unlimited fines for owners of dogs which attack or chase farm animals and give police greater powers under the Dogs Protection Livestock Amendment Act 2025. It also gives police extra powers to seize dogs, enter premises, to recover evidence and take forensic samples from dogs to help identify whether a dog was involved, and extends to incidents on roads and paths as well as farmland.
A North Norfolk beach has been named as the best in the region. The title of the East of England's Best Beach was given to Cromer as part of the Times and the Sunday Times 50 Best UK Beaches Guide, which included four other beaches in Norfolk. Each site is rated using a 12-point checklist which covers cleanliness, water quality, accessibility, parking, toilet and showering facilities, safety, dog friendliness and lifeguard provision. Now in its 18th year, community engagement was added as a criterion to the guide, which recognises the value of active and passionate local involvement. The beach was recently named as one of the best beaches in the UK by the AA in an analysis of 228 Blue Flag awarded beaches. Factors such as safety, local amenities and public favourability were considered in the ranking. Great Yarmouth, Horsey Gap, Wells Next to Sea and Brancaster also made the Times list for the best beaches in the country. The regional title has been awarded to many Norfolk beaches over the years, such as Sheringham in 2024. The publication praised the coastal town as a year-round sweet spot on the Norfolk coast with a blue flag beach and serious social sense.
A celebration of rescue work is set to return to the coast this summer. Cromer RNLI's Lifeboat Day will take place on Sunday the 9th of August, running from 10 a.m. The volunteer run event will feature lifeboat demonstrations, fun activities and stalls along the promenade, with both lifeboat stations open to visitors. John Redmond, lifeboat operations manager at Cromer RNLI, said, "Lifeboat Day is one of the highlights of the summer, giving our community visitors a brilliant chance to experience firsthand the life-saving work of our Cromer volunteers. From meeting the crew and exploring the lifeboats, to watching exciting demonstrations, there's something for everyone to enjoy." This year's event will include lifeboat launches, a display involving RNLI lifeguards, and a Thanksgiving service at 2 p.m. Visitors can meet the volunteer crew, learn about water safety, and discover the work of other emergency services, including HM Coast Guard and Coast Watch. Children can meet Stormy Stan, the RNLI mascot, and enjoy dressing up in crew outfits. Full details of the event are available on the Lifeboat Station's Facebook page.
The search to find a location for a new facility to stop children having to be taken into care has ended, with Norfolk County Council set to spend £1.3 million on a scheme in a Broads village. The County Council has been looking for a site where it could create a new hub to provide short-term residential beds and support for children aged 12 to 17 at risk of going into care. The authorities' hunt led to council officers identifying a suitable property in Hofton, and Nick Taylor, the Reform-led Council's Cabinet Member for Commercial Assets and Revenue Generation, has used his delegated powers to agree County Hall will buy the building to create the facility known as New Roads Hub. The location of the property is not being revealed, given the nature of its use, but it will be the third facility of its kind in Norfolk. The one in Hofton, which will cater for up to 25 children, will cover the Great Yarmouth, Broadland and North Norfolk area. There are already hubs in Norwich and Dereham, which provide young people with dedicated support, including help with education, communication and life coaching. Such hubs help young people to remain within a family environment, whether their own family network or with foster carers. The County Council says since they were launched in 2021, the hubs have prevented more than 560 children from being taken into care, avoiding costs of almost £69 million. Inspectors recently gave their verdict on Norfolk County Council's Children's Services Department and rated it as outstanding in all areas. That marked a significant turnaround in the County Hall Department in just over a decade, with the department going from inadequate to the top rating possible. Inspectors from Ofsted, the Office for Standards in Education, Children's Services and Skills, had visited the council in February to scrutinise areas such as the welfare of children in care, fostering, adoption and child protection.
June was a busy month for Haysborough Lifeboat Station volunteers who have been serving their community in various ways. George Reddell, a crew member, successfully qualified as a navigator on June 16th, passing both written and practical examinations at sea. Expressing his gratitude, he thanked his station and family for their support. Meanwhile, John Davenport and his friend Charlie undertook the Bob Graham Run in the Lake District on June the 24th, raising over £1,000 for the lifeboat station, covering 106 kilometres across 42 peaks. Charlie completed the run with just 3.5 minutes to spare. John, however, had to drop out after 65 kilometres due to a knee injury, but was delighted by the fundraising success. Two crew members, Ellis Spears and Tom Hun, received letters of thanks from the Lord Lieutenant of Norfolk, Lady Danat, for their hard work for the RNLI and their local community. This recognition boosted morale at the station. The station also welcomed new recruit Liam Fairweather, who is now ready for action after receiving his pager from Rachel Kirkham, the lifeboat operations manager. The water safety team has been actively spreading safety messages, reaching over 1,370 people this month. They have been advising on how to float, call for help, and the effects of cold water shock. The crew was called into action on June 28th at 2:08 p.m., responding to reports of two people in trouble on paddle boards. The individuals made it safely to shore as the crew arrived. The RNLI emphasises the importance of calling 999 and asking for the Coast Guard if you see someone in trouble. They also advise paddleboard users to wear a buoyancy aid, carry a means of calling for help, check the weather forecast and tide times, get training and stay within their ability.
A team of agricultural students from Norfolk has triumphed in a national crop growing challenge at Jeremy Clarkson's Diddley Squat Farm. The group from the Royal Agricultural University, RAU, in Gloucestershire won the Association of Independent Consultants, AICC, Ceres Rural Crop Challenge 2026, held as part of the annual Cereals Agricultural Trade event, which took place at the TV Stars farm in Oxfordshire. The winning RAU team consisted of brother and sister duo Charlie and Sophie Turner, aged 21 and 24, from the village of Howe near Porringland, Archie Pegg, 21, from Cromer, and Olivia Royos, 21, from North Walsham. They competed with five other universities to grow the best plot of Skyfall wheat, with judging based on the appearance of their plot, as well as decision-making, communication, and team collaboration. The contest was judged by Ceres Rural Managing Partner and Clarkson Farm star, Cheerful Charlie Ireland, and Roger Davis from Indigro representing AICC. Team leader Olivia Ross said, "The knowledge we have gained and the connections we've made through this experience really are invaluable. I hope to pursue a career in agronomy, so I really threw myself into making sure that our team's crop management was completed to the highest level. The challenge related to many of our degree modules, which really helped us all with our decision making. Thank you so much to Ceres Rural for hosting such a great competition, and we are thrilled to have won it." Professor Nicola Cannon, Professor of Agriculture at the RAU, said, "I'm incredibly proud of our students. What stood out most was their dedication, teamwork, and the care with which they approached every decision throughout the season. This achievement is a testament not only to their technical skills, but also to their professionalism and commitment to excellence."
A new fund dedicated to help farmers cover the cost of clearing fly tipping has been proposed. Matthew Taylor, the Conservative candidate in the upcoming Norfolk Police and Crime Commissioner, has announced plans to help free the countryside of dumped rubbish. Mr. Taylor is the Conservative Vice Chairman of North Norfolk District Council, representing the Stalham ward. Current rules mean that local authorities are responsible for removing rubbish from public land, but waste dumped on private land is the owner's responsibility. Mr. Taylor said the situation was completely unfair and pledged to better support those affected if he was elected Norfolk Police and Crime Commissioner. He said, "When irresponsible, criminally minded individuals dump their rubbish on a farmer's field, a rural business's yard, or a community playing field, it's completely unfair that the victim is left to pay the full cost of clearing it up." The proposal, developed with the Country Land and Business Association, CLA, would see financial support distributed through the Office of the PCC. CLA highlighted that nearly two-thirds of farmers and landowners are affected by fly tipping each year, with some being targeted multiple times a month. Peter Ewan, rural advisor at CLA East, described the problem as a vicious cycle, with victims repeatedly forced to fund costly cleanups. Mr. Taylor said he would work with farming, business and voluntary groups to design the scheme, ensuring support is targeted where it is most needed. He said, "I want to play my part in supporting the hard-working men and women across Norfolk." The announcement comes as rural communities continue to face mounting pressures, with Mr. Taylor linking the issue to wider financial strains on farmers and small businesses. The Norfolk Police and Crime Commissioner election will take place on Thursday, July the 16th. The other candidates are Christopher Brown, Liberal Democrat, Mark Buckton, Restore Britain, Beth Jones, Labour, businessman Marcus Piercy, Independent, Martin Shamira, Green, and Colin Sutton, Reform UK. The by-election, which has an estimated cost of £2 million, was triggered after Sarah Taylor, who had held the role since 2024, initially for Labour and latterly as an independent, resigned with immediate effect.
You are listening to edition number 2025 of The Mardler, recorded on Friday the 10th of July 2026. We have articles about Norfolk's Great Barrier Reef, a 92-year-old park runner, an upcoming three-day Mediterranean fiesta, and lifeboat volunteering training achievements, plus the Mardler magazine supplement, and details of some What's On events, but we have just one letter to the editor of the North Norfolk News, reporting that Northrep's Armed Forces Day was a blazing success.
Armed Forces Day dawned, and we were so lucky to manage holding our Armed Forces Day in spite of the very warm weather forecast. And we fully understood that one or two exhibitors outside cancelled, heat being the issue. Squadron leader Kevin Green was our parade marshal for the day and formed up the parade, including cadets, together with standard bearers, our branch standard at the head, and the parade took place led by a piper and afterwards one of the 11 dignitaries that were in attendance stepped forward and opened our event, immediately followed by a peal of bells ringing out from our lovely St. Mary's Church. Everyone was warned, eyes to the skies, as the first flypast courtesy of Northrep's airfield came over. There was much to see, to get involved in both inside and outside too. The primary school pupils of Northrep's exhibited their poetry, and these were judged too, and there were three prizes awarded to be presented after this event. We went back a bit in history with the Redcoats, who came along and supported us. Our Naffy Caffey was, as you can imagine, very busy with teas, coffees, squash drinks and tasty eats. And thanks to Jason, landlord of our village pub, he ran a bar, and yes, we had ice creams on sale too. We were delighted to welcome the Queen's Dragoons. They were great. Our sealed auction went off well, which included contributions from the Red Arrows, Typhoon Display Team, and any other exhibits, which we were honoured to receive with many thanks. Military vehicles were also present, and at least 17 military motorbikes were present. The furthest one travelled from was Birmingham, and several classic cars arrived, and NHS paramedics and first responders. The Eastern Daily Press stall also with their goodie bags, and Chatterbox local group from the Catholic Church, Cromer, run by our branch secretary, had their stand of crafts, and we support her also with her work in the community. And we were all delighted to welcome with their carers and manager residents from Halsey House, Cromer. Inside RBL, Branches, Remy, Poppy Lottery, Great Weapons Display, Royal Observer Corps, RAF Museum, Nita said, Blind Veterans, Vision Norfolk, Scotty's Little Soldiers, John Needham, that well-known military historian and collector from Cromer, and so much more. Another display of weapons, and then RAF cadets and their simulator. A great raffle with many donations of prizes received with our thanks. A great event. Our branch is very honoured to have organised yet again, overwhelmed with grateful thanks for all the support for the Armed Forces Day, when we were able to salute and thank all for looking after us, the servicemen and women today on the sea and land, also in the air. Royal Navy, Army and Royal Air Force. Lorna Fish, Northrep's chairman, and very proud to be.
Forthcoming events include a Briston yard sale on Sunday the 12th of July between 9:30 a.m. and 2 p.m. Refreshments and maps can be sourced from the Pavilion Briston or phoning 0776 622 8720. The Aylsham Roundtable Beer and Gin Festival 2026 is on Friday the 17th and Saturday the 18th of July at the Town Hall Marketplace, Aylsham, from 6 p.m. Admission is £5 and it raises funds for local charities. Finally, there is a summer concert at All Saints Church, Eddingthorpe, on Saturday the 18th of July, featuring Jane Everard and Joe Ballard. Doors open at 5:30 for a 6 p.m. start. Tickets are £12.50, and if interested, call 01692 402 337 or 0778 7561 850.
We turn now to this week's Mardler magazine supplement. We include Remembering Past Clocks, an up-and-coming Norfolk festival, and our historical treasures, plus a report from our roving reporter. But first, why Wild Norfolk is for everyone. I try to get up every day at dawn to walk, from early spring to autumn. I've often walked for 2 hours before I sit to work. Walking keeps me close to nature, which, after all, is what I write about, and it clears my head. Sometimes in summer, when I'm feeling self-indulgent and when time is on my side, I'll stop for coffee as I'm reaching home. This is important to the writing, you understand. One day, just recently, when I was sitting at a pavement cafe with a coffee, a young man came up and asked whether he could join me. Always interested to learn from others, I said yes. He looked on edge, in need of company, and it soon emerged that he was sleeping rough. Seeing me look up at passing birds, the young man remarked how loud the bird song was where he'd been sleeping on the beach. I told him about the birds in song around us while we spoke. "Wow, you really are a nature boy," he said. Then, quite unprompted, he shared an observation. "The other day," he said, "I was watching this little bird, really close to me. It was completely black and white. I'd never seen anything like it." "Was it running on the ground?" I asked, and he said yes. Ah, that will have been a pied wagtail. In nature conservation, we talk a lot about connection with the natural world. With compelling evidence on our side, we point out that humans tend to function best, to be happiest and most relaxed when we have access to green spaces. This, we argue, makes intuitive sense, as we humans and our relatives evolved in nature. And for hundreds of thousands of years, we lived in nature, until the last 2 centuries, the industrial and agricultural revolutions, and now the digital age. A love of nature, biophilia, as it was termed by the great biologist Edward Wilson, makes evolutionary sense. Here, in my young friend's observation of a wagtail, was a powerful example of our inherent love for nature. He was someone for whom life was unremittingly tough, who for whatever reason struggled against modern society in the UK. In spite of this, because of it perhaps, he was enchanted by an encounter with a bird whose name he did not know. And he chose to share this enchantment with a stranger drinking coffee at a pavement table. In the days since we met, my mind has often wandered back to this young man, hoping he's found the job he wanted, hoping he's found a warm, safe place to rest his head. Hoping, too, that nature still brings him fascination and comforts him against the challenges of life. When I was a boy, a very cerebral, very driven boy, I turned to nature to learn, to stretch my mind, to see new things. I still love learning, and every naturalist loves to see new things. But these days, I turn to nature for solace, to give life shape, and for the comfort of familiarity. That is why I walk the same routes every day, day after day, week after week, month after month. I can be found at dawn in the same spots by the River Wensum. In early spring each year, I'm thrilled to hear the first chiff-chaff in my sleepy patch of woodland, scrub and wetland beside the river. Each migrant bird that joins the chorus through the spring, blackcap, willow warbler, whitethroat, sedge warbler and many others, brings me joy. I welcome each aloud with all the love with which I greet my dearest friends. In September, as the swallows leave the village pond by which I live, my dawns and dusks are full of redwings on migration. Then, as the sugar beet is lifted, pink-footed geese pass overhead, bringing ancient stories from their summer on the tundra. These species, plus the flowers and butterflies and dragonflies and grasshoppers I have known in Norfolk all my life, are the touchstones of my year. They make the year make sense. They give my life its matrix and its meaning. I would be lost without them. I look back on childhood Nick with warmth, but for his impatient thirst to see, to hear, to learn, to know, I would not recognise today the shy mew of the bullfinch in the blackthorn. I would not know the squealing fury of the common gulls in winter, nor the introspective chirrups of dark bush crickets in autumn's blackening bramble. I do not judge young Nick for hungering to see new things. But middle-aged Nick is wiser. He sees, I see, the pattern of it all, the joy in simply being outside, the wonder of children planting seeds, the thrill of icy wind and lashing rain, the fascination that a person without a home can feel for a bird whose name he does not even know. These are moments of pure connection with who we truly are. Our Norfolk Wildlife Trust strategy, launched in 2023, has the title A Wilder Norfolk for All. These are not glib words. We mean that wildlife and wild Norfolk are for absolutely everyone in society. Whether you're a person experiencing homelessness, a wheelchair user, a neurodivergent person, a person of colour, a member of the LGBTQ plus community, a person in older age, or none of the above, we believe you have the same right to a life-changing encounter with a pied wagtail. You have the right to birdsong, like that of the swallow I can hear through my open window as I write. You have the right to walk in a bluebell wood each spring. You have the right to marvel at the scaly beauty of an adder. And having these rights, which we work tirelessly to defend for you, you have the opportunity to join us in the fight for wildness right across our beautiful county. The fight for a wilder Norfolk truly is for all. That article by Nick Aitchison appeared in the July 2026 issue of the Norfolk Magazine.
Next, once upon a time, our clocks had some stylish charm. Emma fondly remembers the timepieces she has loved and which made sure she got to work on time. This morning, as is the case most days and has been for many decades, I was awoken by the sound of the alarm going off, signalling time for my other half to leap into action and make the morning cup of tea. But what differs from previous years is that the alarm now comes courtesy of his mobile phone rather than from an analogue clock. I do have an alarm clock as well, mind you, but it is now used more as a backup, just in case the phone has been left out of earshot in another room or has run out of battery. Call me old-fashioned, but I still like to see the time if I wake up in the middle of the night, so I've always insisted on a suitable bedside clock, preferably with illuminated numbers and hands. Now powered by a battery rather than having to be wound regularly, my clock matches the room and has a fairly gentle bleep that gently increases in volume. This is a far cry from my childhood days in the 1970s, when we were all awoken by the literally alarming sound of Mum and Dad's tea-made clock going off in the mornings. It announced daylight's arrival like a donkey braying loudly and in no way eased you into the new day. However, I can honestly say we never slept through it. My love affair with clocks began at an early age when my grandparents had a stylish arch-shaped version made from wood. It took pride of place on the mantelshelf over the fireplace, and the reassuringly loud tick was the backdrop to many animated conversations in their front room. According to my mum, when Nana grew older, she would take the clock upstairs to the bedroom at night. Mum said she would say she was unable to sleep without the tick of the clock in the background. If it stopped in the night, she would wake up. When I look back at them now, some of these clocks were like works of art, not just functional timepieces. Compared to the dull rectangular shape of today's phones, clocks were well-designed statement pieces in their own right. The first I acquired was a bedside travel clock, which was a hands-me-down from my parents when they graduated to the Tees Maid. It was a stylish number with a camel-coloured leather-look casing, which could be folded up and fitted into a suitcase. Not that we went very far to need a travel clock in those days, but when I was old enough to go off for weekends away, it always accompanied me. Then, when I secured a job as a broadcast journalist, I had to be at work by 5:30 a.m. Being even a minute late would result in missing the news feeds from London, which had to be transferred to tape for the impending bulletins. Such was my anxiety at the possibility of lateness and a severe ticking off by a draconian boss, I ended up with a stack of clocks, all set with the alarms ready to sound at 4 a.m. At the bottom was one of those early radio clock combos, layered with a chunky standard alarm clock and the travel clock on top. Goodness knows why I bothered, because I literally spent most of the night awake staring at the clock stack just in case they all malfunctioned simultaneously. I got to know the make, model and every detail of each clock from fixating on them for so long. On the plus side, they never let me down and I was never late for work, although most of the time I was too shattered from lack of sleep to care who, if anyone, was listening to my news bulletins. As my eyesight began the inevitable decline that comes with squinting at shorthand for too long, I opted for a digital clock, which projected the time onto the ceiling or wall in large digits. This was both confronting and reassuring, depending on what time it was. I spent all of my radio career with one eye on the studio wall clock, which was regularly checked for accuracy to avoid disaster for the newsreader due to the bulletins being so precisely timed. If I went out on a lunch break, the clock on the town centre church would remind me of the time in no uncertain terms, as it chimed every 15 minutes. My mum's most notable timekeeper is a grandfather clock, which was left to us by an old family friend. This was because my sister was always fascinated with the clock when she was a child. It doesn't actually work, but it's still quite an impressive piece of furniture. My nephew, however, has never shared his mother's affection for the grandfather clock, branding it spooky. At one time, our retired neighbours in the adjoining house had a cuckoo clock. It would drive us nuts going off at all hours, including through the night. Then when they went away for long holidays, they would wind the clock up to its full potential before jetting off. Mercifully, over the ensuing days, the cuckooing would gradually get slower, less frequent, and less vociferous. During my career, I've written stories about elaborate clocks with illustrious histories, some in difficult-to-access tower-top locations. So every time the clocks go forward or backwards each March and October, I spare a thought for the people whose job it is to wind and maintain these historic timepieces. Despite the obvious palaver involved in manually resetting analogue clocks, there is still something reassuring about not having to rely on your mobile phone for absolutely everything. That article by Emma Brennan was from the EDP, 28th of May 2026 issue.
And now our historical treasures. One of the many wonders of England is the sheer volume of historical treasures peppering our small nation. In all corners of the land, you'll find clusters of English heritage sites that bring the rich tapestry of our past to life. And with a fair wind, you can visit more than one in a single day. I used to go on regular jaunts to Shropshire, so I was keen to return to a couple of old favourites in Homer Abbey and Rochester Roman City and take in Shrewsbury Flax Mill Maltings, which had opened since my last visit to the county. So I hop in the car for an away day that promises tales of towering industry, bucolic monasticism, and Roman decadence. Forget the huge skyscrapers of Chicago and New York City. The grandparents of these giant buildings looks out over Shrewsbury, where men of iron raised Britain's Industrial Revolution to new heights. I rush for the windows to gasp at the view, as workers surely did in 1797 when their new factory was opened. Did they too marvel at the visible metal skeleton on the inside, the crossbeams and pillars that made five-story engineering possible, or were they simply overwhelmed by the roar of machines and clouds of dust? My guide paints a scene, then pauses to allow stillness and silence for contemplation. It's entrancing. The name Shrewsbury Flax Mill Maltings testifies to the building's two uses, each of which lasted for roughly 90 years. A single spindle and a reel of linen thread are the only remaining artefacts of the flax factory that, at its height, employed about 800 people to spin the fibre into threads for making linen cloth. It feels like a shell with spirits inside. The lights went out when the mill was converted into a maltings. On the outside walls of the attached cross mill, I can see all the windows bricked up, for barley needs to be stored in near dark. Brewing history sits within the factory, in rusting machinery, a kiln and a huge tower of emptiness where a grain elevator was installed in 1897, and in photographs of flat-capped men who smile with bravado at the camera. On rising ground 3 miles to the east, the ruins of Homer Abbey present a stark contrast and tantalising evidence of cushy monasticism where black-robed Augustinians were serviced by a platoon of servants at an institution sponsored by local gentry buying social and spiritual credit. It's there in the highly decorated archway through which these priest monks processed on saints' days into church while ordinary folk slunk through a narrow porch opposite. It's there in the delicate remains of window tracery in the abbot's lodgings and the sculpted saints between columns fronting the chapter house, crafted to impress important visitors. And inside the chapter house itself, there's a reminder that home improvements are nothing new. A gorgeous timber ceiling installed to create a first floor, only decades before the abbey's dissolution in 1539. What conversations went on in this tiny debating chamber on the quality of their last meal and the meaning of life? This abbey is small and intimate and housed a small number of devotees. When you step out of the west window and behind the sheltering walls wrapped around the cloister, it's easy to imagine the steady devotion of men who tended the community's sick and poor and had an armoury or hospice built for that purpose. A visitor walks over the turf floor of the church nave, up a series of stepped levels, it was built inside the hill, to the altar. And I wonder if, like me, he hears the sound of sandaled feet on stone flags and the words of a sermon from an echoing pew. I leave Homond well before evening prayer and pick up the sinuous River Severn for 6 miles to join a Roman legion at the city of Viriconium Coroviorum. Here, an interpretation board whisks visitors back to its earliest days when soldiers guarded the river crossing and battled with the Cornovial tribe, whose fortress tops a nearby hill known as the Rekin. "It's behind you," says the board. I swivel round, and the troublesome hill fort seems far too close for comfort. This city, one we know today as Wroxeter, is introduced to us in the 2nd century after the garrison was overwritten by Roman Britain's 4th biggest city. It had a settled community fronted by a large, leisured class who enjoyed a decadent cocktail of baths, booze, bread and olives. The key to appreciating just about every Roman site in Britain lies in stirring our imagination above the bare foundations, and Wroxeter has stepped up since I was here last, more than a decade ago. I could stand, as I did, at one end of the basilica and look out to the 7-metre-high stretch of wall at the opposite corner. But today, a new and extraordinary realistic illustration paints in the missing 3/4. The other sides, the roof, the people walking its length, wearing gowns and togas. It's making the basilica interior real, just as the audio guide fills in character with imagined chatter and gossip, as well as the words of historians, building both picture and understanding. I cross the ancient road of Watling Street to explore the reconstruction of a Roman townhouse, built with materials that would have been available at the time. Then my visit ends with a second look at the small museum, which tells Wroxeter's story in a choice of selection of objects found here. I spy an exquisite necklace and wine beaker, and a sculpted hand holding a severed head by the hair. It's a stark acknowledgement that the Romans embraced both beauty and beastliness. This tour has brought more than a variety. It's enabled me to drop into 3 huge points in history and find meaningful common threads and contrasts, rather than treating them in isolation. Most of all, it has me thinking again about the financial or political power that allows a state or institution or individual to dominate the lives and livelihoods of so many within their orbit. Indeed, it tells us about the shaping of history. That article appeared in the English Heritage magazine, Spring 2026 edition.
And next, Worstead's upcoming celebration. There is a moment each summer when the quiet North Norfolk village of Worstead transforms. For one weekend, this village of around 1,000 people becomes a vibrant hub, welcoming more than 10,000 visitors. This year, that transformation carries extra significance as Worstead Festival marks its 60th anniversary. A milestone that speaks not only to longevity, but to the enduring strength of community spirit. Current chair, Jane Bond, has been involved in the festival for many years and has been at the helm for nearly a decade. "I started off when I was a child doing pony rides," she said, "and then got involved again when I moved back to the village about 15 years ago. It's an amazing milestone to get to 60 years. She continues. "We like to call ourselves Norfolk's biggest village festival, and nobody's contested that yet," she adds with a laugh. While technically there may not have been 60 individual festivals, with recent years interrupted by the pandemic, the sense of history remains deeply rooted. The event began in 1966. On the very day England won the World Cup. and was originally created to raise funds for repairs to the village's striking St. Mary's Church. That church remains at the heart of everything. One of the largest in the region, even bigger than Norwich's St. Peter Mancroft, it stands as a reminder of Worcester's historic importance in the wool trade. "It's a magnificent building," says Jane. "As you approach the village, the first thing you see is the tower. It's quite spectacular. It's very much the centre of the village and of the festival." Over the decades, Worcester Festival has evolved and has even welcomed royalty. The Queen Mother visited one year. But its purpose has remained consistent: to bring people together and give back. Funds raised have supported everything from building the village hall to ongoing grants for local charities and community projects. Treasurer Jenny Gubbins says the scale of that support continues to surprise. "Last year we gave around £37,000 in grants, which is a lot of money for a small village festival," she explains. Beneficiaries range from the local food bank and first responders to schools, community groups, sports club, and church repair projects. "We focus on local causes within Worcester and the surrounding area, and particularly capital projects that make a lasting difference." Despite its growth, the festival has consciously resisted becoming too commercial. Around 15 years ago, a shift in direction brought the focus back to its rural roots. "It had got a bit too big and was losing its identity," Jane explains. "So we made a real effort to bring it back to being a traditional village festival, celebrating local crafts and community." That ethos is evident throughout the weekend. Visitors will find dozens of carefully curated stalls with an emphasis on local makers and producers. Under the banner "Made in Worcester," craftspeople showcase everything from pottery and crochet to blacksmithing and artwork. "There's something special about supporting people from your own area," says Jane. "We're very lucky to have so many talented makers locally." Food is another highlight, with a strong Norfolk flavour running through the programme. A large food marquee hosts demonstrations from respected local chefs, while producers offer everything from artisan cheeses to wines and candies chutney. "We've got incredible food producers in Norfolk," says Jenny. "The food tent is always a big draw." The festival is also designed to be accessible. Entry remains deliberately affordable: £10 for adults, £15 for a weekend ticket, and free for children under 16, with much of what's on offer included in the price. "We want it to be a proper family day out," Jane says. "People can bring a picnic if they want, and once they're in, there's a huge amount to enjoy without extra cost." That includes a packed programme of entertainment. Attractions manager Kevin Geary plays a central role in shaping the lineup. "We've got something for everyone," he says, "from BMX acrobats and the Outlaws Wild West stunt show to heavy horses and dog agility." Heavy horses, in particular, are a long-standing favourite, appearing in full regalia and drawing big crowds for their performances. The dog show brings its own brand of unpredictability and humour, especially during the popular lure racing, where dogs, not always obediently, chase a target across the field. There's also live music throughout the weekend. This year's acts include The Booze Brothers and Agent Orange, alongside a 5-mile run on the Friday night, organised by North Norfolk Beach Runners, that has become an increasingly important part of the festival. St. Mary's Church hosts its own programme of events, including choirs, a flower festival, teas and raffles, offering a chance to pause and soak in the setting. Behind the scenes, the scale of the operation is considerable. Planning for each festival begins almost as soon as the previous one ends. We have to book marquees and equipment straight away, Jane explains. If we don't, we risk not getting them. Planning ramps up after Christmas, and before you know it, the festival is just weeks away. In the days leading up to the event, the transformation is dramatic. We start setting up on the Wednesday, she says. By the weekend, the whole village is a hive of activity. Then by Monday afternoon, it's all gone again, back to a quiet village. What makes it all possible is the volunteer workforce at its core. It's an incredible achievement, says Jane. Everyone involved gives their time freely, and that's something I'm immensely proud of. For many, involvement begins almost by accident. Former chairman Simon Cole, who has been part of the festival for around 30 years, recalls how simply moving to the village drew him in. Someone introduced themselves over the fence, and before I knew it, I was involved, he laughs. That sense of openness remains key to the festival's future, and there is a strong push to encourage younger volunteers to get involved. It's a great way to gain experience, Jane says. Whether you're interested in events, marketing or hospitality, there are real skills to be learned here. Simon agrees. We want it to thrive, and that means bringing in the next generation. It's our legacy to the village. For some, that journey has already begun. Younger volunteers are taking on significant roles, from managing food areas to helping shape the festival's digital presence, gaining valuable experience along the way. And while the work is demanding, we're all absolutely shattered afterwards, Jane admits, the rewards are clear. You look out over that field, full of happy people enjoying themselves, and there's nothing quite like it, she says. It's a wonderful feeling to know you've helped make that happen. Worsted Festival is on July the 25th and 26th. Find out more at worstedfestival.org. That item's taken from the Norfolk Magazine of July 2026. To finish off this edition of the magazine, we have an on-the-spot report from our roving reporter, Beverly Hopkins, where she chats with Mardler listener Arthur Barwick about times gone by. We will bring you the second part of this interview next week.
Hello, Mr. Barwick. Thank you very much for inviting me to come back and talk to you again. Some of our listeners might remember you gave us a very interesting report about your beekeeping, but I'm here to record something very different. Perhaps you tell the listeners what it is you want to talk about.
Well, yeah, maybe I'd like to talk about my younger life. And I'll start right at the beginning. I was born the 31st of December, 1932, at 2 minutes to midnight. Now, the reason I know it was 2 minutes to midnight, the doctor that attended, looked at his watch and he said, it's 2 minutes to midnight, he'd have to be an old year's baby, not a new year's baby.
But that wasn't here in Norfolk?
Yes, it was in Norfolk, it was at Bristol. I was born to quite a large family. I had 10 sisters and 2 brothers. And they were all born in the same house, in the same room. My dad was a smallholder and we rented this little farm from Lord Hastings at Melton Constable. It was a 4-bedroomed cottage and it was very primitive. Well, for this day it was modern. We loved it. We didn't know any difference. There was no water. There's a well in the garden that we got water from. There was no electricity. We had all the lighting we had was our oil lamp and candles. The oil lamp I've still got, stands on the table there now. Yeah. I remember when I was a boy, I used to trim the wick every day, put it in the kerosene to light it, and it was a brass one, so I have to polish it with brass oil. And I used to do this for my mum when I was very young, before I went to school. The well was outdoors, and it was there was a bucket on a chain on a roller, and you used to crank the handle and lower the bucket down into the well to get the water and bring it up. And that's how we'd pour the water from that bucket into another bucket, bring it indoors and put it in the pantry. We called it a pantry or the larder. When we wanted water, we'd have to go and do that every time.
Including washing water?
Washing for everything. And all the cooking was done on one coal-fired stove. It had hobs each side, which you could cook in the hobs, you could bake in there, or you could boil. Up the chimney was a hake, or you called it a hake.
Hake, H-A-K-E?
A hake. On the hake hung the kettle. When it boiled, it would sing.
And you had a happy childhood, I'm guessing.
I had a lovely childhood. Uh-huh. Yeah, I mean, it was very primitive, considering the loo was 20, 30 yards down the garden.
Was it really?
It was so different. That's why I think I'd just like to talk a little about it. So on this little farm, my dad grew things like blackcurrants, strawberries and raspberries, mainly fruit. And we had chickens, we had ducks, we had a pony, we had pigs. We had a ferret, we used to keep rabbits, and we had cats, we had a dog. So you can imagine how it
quite
was
a menagerie.
In this little country cottage. So it was, to me, it's very interesting. Dad had this little farm and grown these things, and he also had greenhouses. We grew tomatoes, cucumbers, lettuce and things, which... And most of our projects went to Covent Garden, and Dad would take them on a trailer, a little flatbed trailer, pulled by the pony, and he would take them to Hindlewestern Station, and they'd go on the train to Norwich and cross the city, then down to London. So they went to Hindlewestern. We used to call Hindlewestern in those days, we called it Hindall, because we talked, that was country talk. When the fruit was ready for picking, we would have all the ladies and their families come in from the village to pick the fruit.
Oh, right, yeah.
And it was a very big occasion, because it was so remote that I didn't meet many people. I hardly saw anybody. And suddenly all the village descended on our little farm. Mum would make tea, cakes and tea and sandwiches for them. And it was in a little corrugated shed. Oh, it was like a garage. It was built out of corrugation.
Yeah.
And round it to sit on, it had orange boxes, because you had to collect orange boxes in those days, with a sack on them to sit on. And they would all sit round in a circle. And the sound coming out of there was unbelievable.
They're
all chitter, chatter, chitter, chatter.
I can imagine.
And I used to listen to it as a little boy. I'd put my ear and listen to all this chitter, chatter.
Yeah. And did you help with harvesting?
Not really, no. I used to pick blackcurrants and fruit, yes.
Yeah.
I used to go, because I used to get paid for it. I'd get so much upon it.
Oh, of course, you said about pocket money, yeah.
More pocket money again.
Yeah. What a lovely life you led, Mr. Barwick. It sounds idyllic.
Maybe we will leave it there.
And those items conclude this week's magazine supplement. Our thanks go to the editors and contributors of the EDP, the English Heritage Magazine, and Norfolk Magazine for permission to use their material.
We now finish with our last selection of news and views, starting with what amazing creatures lurk off Norfolk's Great Barrier Reef. Crystal clear waters have given a colourful and revealing glimpse of the hidden world beneath the waves off Sheringham. A diver has captured the teeming life of the North Norfolk chalk reef as he enjoyed snorkelling among a variety of aquatic marvels, such as graceful jellyfish, velvet swimming crabs, and endangered eels. The reef is one of Europe's largest chalk reef systems, just metres from the beach. It is often compared to a mini Great Barrier Reef for its gullies, ledges, and spectacular biodiversity. Chris Taylor, 54, and a photographer from Sheringham, took a dive while the waters were calm. Mr. Taylor caught 4K footage of moon and compass jellyfish, comb jellies, wrasse, velvet swimming crabs, brown edible crab, and even a critically endangered European eel hiding in the seaweed. He said, "Normally we don't get weather this calm until August, when the sediment finally settles again." The endangered eel was seen only 25 metres from the shoreline, although Mr. Taylor travelled 100 to 150 metres offshore. Mr. Taylor has been swimming in the reef since he was a teenager, and he said, "It's a special place, with lots of colourful, interesting species contributing to the reef in their own way." He said, "You never know what you're going to find off the shores here, and that's what makes it so exciting. The wildlife is here all year, but we literally only have a handful of days when the reef becomes visible like this." The footage caught a lot of attention online, with many unaware that so many marine life thrives near the Blue Flag Beach. With further hot weather on the horizon, snorkelers are planning more daytime excursions as well as night swims, when a completely different underwater world comes to life after dark. Having lived Sheringham his whole life and working for 25 years on the town's lifeboat as a crew and helmsman, Mr. Taylor said it's a privilege to be able to show people what is out there. He said, "It amazes me how many people don't realise what's a stone's throw from the shore."
A 92-year-old from Norfolk who became a passionate park runner 2 years ago is now on track to complete his 100th event. Ron Clark from Sheringham first took part in the weekly 5K event in August 2024 at Blickling after a suggestion from his son. Though at first he doubted he could run, he soon found himself embracing the challenge and now looks forward to it every Saturday. Mr. Clark said, "When my wife passed away, I used to meet up with Ian, my son, on the weekends, and we would go on a walk. When he suggested the park run, I said, 'I can't run.' When Ian told me it can be walked, I gave it a try, and we walked together the first time." Park Run said that anyone who completes the 5K in under 50 minutes is a runner, giving Mr. Clark the motivation he needed. He recently recorded a personal best time of 43 minutes 22 seconds and is on track to complete his 100th park run in September. Mr. Clark said, "I look forward to it every week. I've met some very nice people, both at my home Blickling Park Run and Sheringham Park Run. When you finish, there is always someone there to clap you in and make you feel proud." Though he said he was never a runner until just before his 90th birthday, he's no stranger to staying active, playing golf twice a week and having cycled regularly in his youth. He credits Park Run not just for improved fitness, but also for boosting his mood and giving him a strong sense of community. Mr. Clark said, "I am a lot fitter since I started. When I finish the run, I feel so high, it picks you up and lifts your mood."
Live music and Mediterranean flavours will fill the air as a pub brings back its summer fiesta for the second year. The Suffield Summer Fiesta returns to the Suffield Arms in Thorpe Market from August the 14th to the 16th with a bigger programme of food, drink and entertainment. Set in the pub's gardens, the three-day event promises live music, Mediterranean-inspired cuisine and a relaxed atmosphere. George Ash, General Manager at the Suffield Arms, said, "Our aim is to create something genuinely different. We're bringing together great live music, a welcoming and vibrant atmosphere, and food that reflects our restaurant standards, all within a unique outdoor setting. Around 90% of the dishes will be prepared in-house, with a menu featuring tapas, paella, and Mediterranean-style hog roast, barbecue favourites, and a champagne oyster bar. Feel-good ice cream will also be on hand to help guests cool off. The 2026 edition will span 3 days to meet the growing demand, building on the popularity of the Suffield Arms Sunday sessions. The music lineup will be headlined by Jar Wobble, known for his bass work with Public Image Limited and the Invaders of the Heart. He will perform a special family set covering his influential career. Also performing is Little Barry, featuring guitarist Barry Cadogan, who has worked with Primal Scream, Liam Gallagher, Paul Weller, and the Black Keys. Mr. Cadogan is also the composer of the Better Call Saul theme. Other acts include Brazilian-Danish garage rock duo The Corettes and Norfolk's own art rock band Neutrinos. The festival is easily accessible by train, with Gunton Station directly opposite the pub. The event will finish by 11 p.m. and the final train service departs at 11:40 p.m.
Two volunteer RNLI crew members have achieved significant training milestones. Craig Rogers and Pete Abbs of Croma RNLI have completed key assessments that strengthen the life-saving capability of their station. Mr. Rogers is now a fully competent crew member on both of the station's all-weather and inshore lifeboats. He passed his ILB Tier 2 assessment and went on to complete his ALB Tier 2 assessment later the same day. Mr. Rogers, who first joined Croma RNLI in 2007 and returned in 2022 after working overseas, said, "Passing both assessments on the same day was a challenge, but it was a really rewarding experience. Becoming fully competent on both the inshore and all-weather lifeboats is something I've worked hard towards, and I'm pleased to have achieved that." He said his next aim is to become an all-weather lifeboat afloat mechanic. Mr. Abbs, who joined the station in February 2025, has qualified as an ALB navigator. His great-uncle, Donnie Abbs, also served on both the inshore and all-weather lifeboats. Mr. Abbs said, "Passing out as an ALB navigator has been a big achievement for me. There's a lot of training involved and plenty to learn, but it's worth it when you've completed it and can put those skills into practice. My aim now is to keep progressing on the all-weather lifeboat and continue building my experience." John Redmond, Lifeboat Operations Manager at Croma RNLI, praised both volunteers. He said, "These are fantastic achievements for Craig and Pete. Both volunteers have dedicated a considerable amount of their own time to training and development, and their achievements strengthen the capability of our station. Croma RNLI Lifeboat Station has launched its lifeboats 1,435 times and saved 1,294 lives since it was established in 1804.
And that brings us to the end of this edition of The Marbler, with readings from the North Norfolk News. If you have any comments or queries, our listener liaison officer is Imogen Waterson on 01263 587 610. If you have a smartphone, tablet or computer, or know someone who has, you can listen to this and other editions online at marbler.org.uk. You can also use an Alexa smart speaker to listen using the Talking Newspaper skill. Find out the details on our website, marbler.org.uk. But please, when returning the pouch and memory stick, remember to reverse the label. The sound engineer this week was David Mitchell, and the editor-producer was David Audley. And our colleagues in the copying and dispatch room join us in thanking you for listening and wishing you a week to remember. and we look forward to joining you again next Friday. But for now, though, from today's readers, it's cheerio!